papermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
You know, as we begin this program, we should just at least introduce ourselves. You know, I'm Rex Smith. I used to be the editor of the Times Union. I now run something called the Upstate American, where I write every week. Who are you?
Hi, I'm Barbara Lombardo. I teach journalism at UAlbany, and for many years, I was the editor at the Saratogian.
Cool.
And I'm Miles Reed. I'm the editor at the Daily Gazette, family of newspapers in Schenectady, and we operate five daily papers these days.
Uh-huh. Isn't that something? And you, who are you, Guy?
Yeah, thank you. I was cut off by the and Miles Reed. I'm David Gustina, producer of the show, longtime employee of WAMC. I do the morning news. I produce and host the Legislative Gazette, the Capitol Connection, and so much more. The program will be over.
So much more. And so much more. All right.
So great to be here.
It's great to have you in front of the microphone here. We always enjoy it when you do that. You know, I think just an interesting way to get into the program today is to talk about some of the big news stories that folks have been covering and where that presents some of the ethical quandaries that we often face in newsrooms. I think in particular of a really interesting video that I was looking at the other day that David drew to our attention, and that had to do with a dramatic moment when there was an NBC News correspondent, a guy named Gadi Schwartz. And he was covering the Los Angeles fires. The winds were blowing, and suddenly they saw a horse that was trapped, that apparently he thought it had already been singed. And this poor horse was going to get overrun by the flames if he didn't escape. And as it happened, there was a firefighter nearby who owned horses, who worked with them. So Gadi Schwartz got the guy to come up and calm the horse and bring the horse into a paddock where he would be safe, they thought. It was just an interesting moment where you saw a journalist doing something that isn't what you think of journalists doing. He was rescuing a horse in the midst of this terrible conflagration that is a story that has shocked and saddened us all, but he was doing something other than storytelling. And it becomes a question that I think we have probably all of us confronted at one time or another in the newsrooms we've run, in the work that we've been doing, and that is, when does a journalist step outside that storytelling role, or can you without running into ethical quandaries?
Well, I think that part of the issue is the person in the story that you're relaying was inserting themselves into the story, and that becomes the question of when you can do that. And it really depends. I think we need to remember that we are human beings first and journalists second. And if there's an opportunity to save somebody, a person or a horse, and do something that's in the heat of that moment is the right thing to do, you need to do it. And
if you were a reporter covering 9/11, you wouldn't have run into the flaming, collapsing building.
I wouldn't have run into the flaming, collapsing building. And again, this is kind of speculation, but if I was down there, would I have stopped to help somebody who was struggling and to walk away from the scene? I don't know. Maybe I would.
Yeah, I think ideally a journalist does not want to in any way affect actually what happens. What is the outcome of it? But they are human beings. We are human beings, as Barbara mentions. You know, I think it probably happens on a smaller scale, less dramatic than the one that we're discussing with the LA fires. But, you know, it's not uncommon. I've covered criminal trials, for example, where the mother of a murder victim might be, you know, hysterical outside the courtroom. And, you know, journalists are human beings. And I've seen journalists give up a tissue to a grieving mother or maybe a soft drink, even be somebody willing to just talk to them. You know, as long as it does not affect your objectivity with the report, I think in smaller doses, it's okay. But it's super critical that the journalist doesn't inject themselves in the outcome of what's going on.
Do you think, David, in the students that you've taught at UAlbany, don't you run into questions about this where they don't quite understand the line?
Absolutely, Rex, it's almost like you knew to ask me that question. The example I often use in class is that of someone committing suicide. This occurred, unfortunately, at NYU many years ago. A student committed suicide by jumping off the campus building. And there was a photo of it that ran on the front page of the New York Post, and we have a discussion about that. But one of the things that the students want to know increasingly as the years have gone on, and I've taught this in the class, they want to know, why didn't the journalists step in if they were there? If they could take a picture, why weren't they there to help the person or stop the person from jumping? And we go through the machinations of that, that they probably wouldn't have gotten anywhere near the top of that building. The police were already at the scene. They were handling it. There, in that case, most likely wasn't an opportunity. But there are other examples of a journalist where someone is drowning and they are there filming this and they put the camera down and they reach down and they pull the person to safety. So in some cases, that's where I would affect the outcome. If I were a human being in that moment and saw somebody drowning and I was the only one there able to impact that situation, I might take that opportunity to change the course of that person's life. And yet that line for every journalist, case by case, is a consideration we make because we are taught, just as Barbara said, to insert ourselves into the story itself. But am I a human being right now or am I a journalist?
Well, there's a real life instance that I share with my journalism class to discuss as an ethical issue. And it occurred in the 1990s. A photographer named Kevin Carter had taken pictures in the Sudan. And one of them was of a vulture in the background and a starving, emaciated child crawling somewhere. And that won him the Pulitzer Prize. He subsequently committed suicide, by the way. But the ethical issue was, why did he take this picture? What should he have done as a human being to prevent that child? You know, what happened? What was going to happen? What should he have done? Later it was revealed that he had actually lifted up the girl to get her to the food place that she was trying to crawl to, shoot away the vulture. But the broader issue is that where he was taking that picture was, and still is a terrible place, was full of starving children and adults. He couldn't have solved that problem. All around, he just focused it on that one picture because the vulture was in the back. And it told a story that was published in the New York Times and raised awareness of a situation that really changed the course of what was happening there and creating support for people that were starving in that area.
It's hard when you want journalism to be empathetic, and yet if your empathy extends to interfering with your journalism, you're not doing the job. I had a friend who shared a Pulitzer for covering the Ethiopian famine in the early 80s. And I said to him, this is a crazy question, Josh, but where do you eat? And he said, at the Hilton. Because in the midst of famine, there were places where if you had money, you could go. And it was a terrible burden on people. You find this. We have an essay, actually, that David distributed before the show by a journalist named Ayman Ogana, which appeared in the Climate Journalism Review. Ayman Ogana is a wonderful documentarian, a person you wouldn't ordinarily know, but writes about this moment in Baghdad in 2010 when he was behind a camera. There was a terrible rush hour explosion. There were dazed survivors, and he watched this. He said, you know, I found purpose behind the lens. It shields me from the carnage. Things feel more manageable when you seen through a viewfinder. You've heard that from photographers before. And he talked about a young girl staggering forward, her face drenched in blood. He snapped her picture, and she started beating on him. He later found out that her mother had just been killed. Oh. And so this is why, of course, she was beating on him. And it was insensitive, I guess, to be taking that photograph, but it was real. He was covering what was going on there.
Did he use the photograph? Was it published?
I presume.
Well, in the part of the article, the storm inside is just what I began to think about with Barbara and that picture that the photographer committed suicide. The impact, mental health impact on journalists themselves, covering wars, covering famine, covering the fires, covering negative conflicts, are inevitably going to hit your mental health. And how do you deal with that? Many close up, many bury it, compartmentalize, keep going. But at some point, doesn't that leak out? And who cares for the journalist?
Well, there is now something called the Pulitzer Center for Trauma Journalism, which actually focuses on these very issues we're talking about here. But, you know, on the local level, there are ethical challenges that you face in terms of your involvement with the community. that are much more pedestrian, let's say. They don't involve life and death. But I'm sure in your newsroom, Miles, you've had situations where people want to get involved in what's going on in their town, but you're a journalist, you're covering it.
Yeah, you know, for us, it's a conversation that we have to have, especially from the newer, younger journalists that come in. And especially, I would say, in the last 10 years, when there is a renewed interest in advocacy, certainly at the college level, when they come in and then they still retain some of those interests, we counsel them and we actually tell them they have to check that at the door if they're going to be involved. And not just check it at the door, check it in their life. That if they want to still be an advocate on behalf of some effort, that they can't do that and be a journalist at the same time.
Does it depend on what they're covering?
It does to some degree, but at the same time, it's not exclusive for us in terms of what the reporter's beat is, because if a reporter these days, especially in a newsroom, a lot of them jump off their beat occasionally if somebody's on vacation. And so what we don't want is somebody, for example, going on social media and saying Donald Trump is a bad guy, he's a menace, he's going to bring authoritarianism. And then that reporter, potentially a week later, even though they don't cover politics, we have to throw them at that. We are going to subject ourselves to being criticized, saying that this reporter was not objective and clear-headed. So they really have to do that.
What about registering in a political party?
So I counsel not to. I've never been enrolled in any party. We don't mandate it, but I think you just open yourself up again that you're somehow biased on one side.
I think that people think that we're biased on one side or not, no matter what we do or don't do. And I was an outlier as far as political enrollment because I did enroll in a party. And my feeling was that as a citizen, I want to retain my right to vote in primaries. And that is the only way that I can do that. And I felt confident that I was able to run a newsroom fairly. Some people would agree with that. Some people would disagree with that, depending on their point of view.
I think it's interesting. You're giving fuel, however, to the people who say you're biased. But you could say, well, the proof is in the pudding.
The proof is in the coverage. And show me where that shows up.
But people don't understand, I think, how many steps we take to try to avoid bias in our coverage. How much by ethics, by practice, by actually disciplines in the newsroom, by people reading the stories, saying to a reporter, this word is a little bit too hot, mm-hmm. a little bit too loaded. We really work so hard to bring fairness to a story. And I think folks often don't recognize how much effort goes into that and how it's just sort of fundamental to the way we do journalism.
And about how despite all that effort, it's still very difficult to tell the so-called truth about any given event or happening because people come to it with their perspectives, because our sources are going to give their sides of the story. We can't always get right to the essence of that truth.
And it will be, as Barbara says, it will be perceived as biased in any case. There has actually been sociological study of this in a number of platforms that readers bring more bias to what they read than the preparers, the journalists themselves. Bias is in the eye of the beholder, of course.
By the way, we had a journalist here years ago. You remember the Occupy movement? You mm-hmm. know, the 99% versus the 1%. We had a journalist here that got caught. Because he went to one of these rallies as a participant as opposed to covering it. And he was caught in a picture that appeared in the press.
Yeah.
As part of a rally. And he was counseled on it. He was not fired. He didn't go to any more rallies like that.
Well, it's hard. I had a freelancer who went down when Donald Trump first took office. You remember 8 years ago, there mm-hmm. were demonstrations, the Million Woman March. And we had a freelance journalist who got on the bus with the women from here and went to that. And actually then ended up writing a column about it with a photograph in the paper wearing the pink hat. What was the...
I think saying pink hat suffices.
Yeah. And I thought, this is not really a good thing. Even though it's a columnist, even though it's not a staff person, I regretted the situation because I had been pretty strict about this. We had an artist who stood behind the podium with a crowd of people in an advocacy situation and just let his picture be taken. And this is an artist on the staff in the newsroom. And I ended up saying, I'm sorry, I've got to put a letter in your file. This is inappropriate behavior by our standards of community engagement.
Yeah, I have to say, I found it very freeing when I left the newspaper to be able to express my views publicly or on social media to some extent, because I would hold back. I definitely would not do that because people would perceive at the time while I was working that what I'm putting on would affect, oh, if she thinks that way, no wonder they're doing or not doing this, or no wonder their positions are this or that.
Now, we've all had this problem, though, because of the editorial page. That is, our editorial pages express points of view. And for you as editor of the Saratogian, for me when I was the editor of the Record in Troy, I wrote editorials.
And sometimes I didn't totally agree with my editorials.
I know, I did the same thing.
Well, and isn't today's social media one giant editorial page? I mean, really what's happening is you're stripping that away and people don't see it as editorial. They see it as news, as information. I'm getting my information here. And it's really, we're talking about the quality of the information.
And it gets skewed because when people think of journalism, they think of CNN, Fox, MSNBC. So much of that is not news reporting. It is commentary. It's panels of people sitting there giving you their opinions. And that skews what people mean when they say media. The media is all biased.
Yeah. Well, Dave, when you talked about your students, and Miles, you talked about the younger, newer reporters, and Dave, you're probably experiencing the same thing where I feel that I need to be very careful about how I talk about politics to my students because I'm not trying to indoctrinate, I'm not trying to tell them what my position is, but I want them to be able to be aware of what's going on in the world and to think critically, be able to think critically without me relaying what my personal position is on stuff.
And that's, at least for me, I don't know about you, Barbara, increasingly difficult in the Trump era because he has taken such a direct line attacking the press. And so you're kind of forced to remind journalists, what are the basic rules of journalism here? If he's attacking a press, what is he going after and is he right? You have to sort of call the truth there where it is and be willing to say that Trump is lying. And inevitably, you're going to butt heads with those students who don't fully understand in the context of teaching them that journalism. Why are you doing that? Why are you even bringing politics into it? But I found I had to because of the danger that we were seeing with the basic fact checking and information veracity that seemed to be disappearing.
And I ask, are you the enemy of the American people? How about you over there?
But you could see a conservative person in the class going, see, they're liberals. There are a bunch of liberal professors teaching me here. And I assure you, when I'm teaching journalism, I'm teaching journalism. And there are some basic things that are happening to journalism right now that are so threatening that we may lose a lot of this verification. And certainly lost a whole bunch of trust since I started in this field.
You know, a lot of times I think younger folks might only have experienced Trump and this past 8 years of how he has dealt with the media. I try to remind especially younger staffers that this is not exclusive to Republicans to potentially attack the media, to try to control it, to shut them off. We all have been in the media landscape in Albany over the last 30 years. And I would say that Democrats have been equally difficult to deal with. We've dealt with state administrations that have shut down our access. They've been a very aggressive. I'm sure we've all gotten calls from spokespeople from both parties, really aggressive, trying to curtail some kind of coverage, saying, if you take another step on this, you know, it's going to be a bad thing for your reporter. We're going to shut them off. So I think it's just a reminder that right now there is certainly a concern about what the Trump administration will do. But it's not just them potentially trying to affect what we do.
You're absolutely right. Politicians in general don't like the press. They think we're a bunch of gotcha journalists and all we want is negative stories. Well, the truth is we want news. And yes, there is a criteria. But at the same time, for public media, we want you to talk about your ideas. What are you doing there at the legislature? What are you doing running the state financial apparatus? You know, I can't get the governor. She's a Democrat to come on the Capitol Connection. We've had so much trouble over the years with Elise Stefanik not coming on the Congressional Corner or Republican. So you're right. It goes across the spectrum there. But it's also, you know, we have a traditional difficult relationship with the police. They want to hold information. We want to get information. There are natural adversaries in some sense, but I think the press is just approaching it from their duty, from their obligation to get information, whereas the other side is
trying to control the information and trying to shape it as best they can to enable their careers in politics to continue. So there is that natural tendency. But what is different now is that you have such an aggressive effort to distort the truth. And that's why real journalism does have to call a lie a lie. And that's what makes it seem as though we are biased when we're calling out lies as being what they are. And that is a very difficult thing. That's one of the reasons why audiences are diminishing. You have it from both the left and the right. On the right, you have people turning away from real journalism because they think that it's biased. On the left, you have people turning away because what they're reading is so painful, mm-hmm. people tell me often. They just don't want to encounter the news. So we have a huge problem in journalism that I think we are all grappling with, and that is the decline of audience, the loss of the core strength of most of our journalism has been that we are the way that people understand how to be citizens. We give them the information they need to exercise to be citizens. This is the Jeffersonian ideal of democracy, that with information, citizens can make good choices. But as people turn away from verifiable information, from the journalism of truth, we're unable to do our part to sustain democracy.
But Mr. Rex Smith, is it only temporary? In other words, are we going to get a Trump bump?
The Trump bump. You know, some places have had a Trump bump. You know,
that's right.
The Guardian.
And the numbers are staggering.
It's staggering. And that is a rare situation because what's the number, David? The Guardian,
said the outlet's end of 2024 fundraising campaign ended
like
with $5.13 million and the media contributions more than doubled the previous record of $2.2 million.
Isn't that something?
The Guardian U.S. also reported $16.1 million in pledged contributions, which it defines as the long-term value of recurring subscriptions. That's 16, up from 6.12 million in the same period a year earlier.
So there are two sides to this. That is a record surge in donations to the Guardian U.S., which calls itself a truth teller about the president-elect, protector of the free press. It is, most people would say, well, the Guardian is on the left slant of things in a divided media landscape. So there's a Trump bump, but on the other side, the Trump gully has to do with MSNBC. MSNBC has dropped off significantly, so has CNN.
Which is why I said temporary, because some of the claims here are people are turning away after the election. Those that were disappointed in the result would maybe most of them be MSNBC, let's say, watchers. They're not happy. They're tuning away. But when Trump officially takes power, they may return again and be looking for those same outlets to maybe give them what they want. And so you just see Rachel Maddow. Oh, now they're going to put Rachel Maddow back on for Trump's first 100 days.
Yeah.
Boost the ratings a little bit. You see, this is where we talk about, and Trump accused the media of this, and I don't think he was wrong or lying about this, which is they get better ratings when he's on because he says outrageous things. And he draws in viewers and listeners and readers. And I don't think there's any way around that. So you can see where him being back in office may, in the back offices, being whispered, hey, this is going to help. And let me throw public broadcast under the bus for a moment. Don't think that when I see these numbers for The Guardian, I don't think, woof, because we're already hearing from people who listen to WAMC. If the Trump administration takes the money away for public media, I've heard at least two pledges come in with comments, I'll double my pledge because we want to keep this place around. So maybe we'll see a bump right here at WAMC.
I worry. I think that the future of journalism may well hinge upon philanthropy. With all due respect to the for-profit enterprises that we three editors over here have worked for, the nonprofit sector may be what needs to sustain most journalism going forward, so that in the same way that, you know, the arts have always depended upon philanthropy for centuries, great art, visual art, music, sculpture, theater, always has relied upon philanthropy.
Patrons of the arts.
Patrons of the arts. So, you know, since I've left the newsroom, I'm allowed to be on boards now. So I've been for 4 years the board chair of Albany Pro Musica, this wonderful choral ensemble, which derives one quarter of its income from earned income, that is ticket sales, and three quarters from the generosity of people who care about great music in our community. And I think that that model is going to have to be what sustains journalism going forward. There will be some for-profit enterprises that can sustain themselves, not at the scale they used to be. Our newsrooms used to be bigger than they are now at those newspapers. But
boy, that's an understatement. Wow.
But I think that there's going to have to be this melding that includes great philanthropic support for journalism, including public broadcasting.
You heard it right here first, folks. Rex has just agreed to write a check to end the fund drive.
And I have to say that I'm on the board of this great thing, New York Focus. I'm actually doing an event for them up at Cafe Lena. And this is a great enterprise that exists to do investigative reporting on New York State. That kind of stuff is really important for the future of journalism.
I hope you're going to be singing.
No, isn't that terrible? I get to go to one of the great venues for music in America, and I'm not singing, I'm talking.
Well, you can just sort of sing when you walk in.
Newspapermen.
Exactly. Yeah. You'll probably get a whole group singing in there.
I don't know any media outlet that I talk to on a regular basis that is not looking to sort of create this additional stream of revenue in philanthropic support. We're not unique at the Gazette. You know, we saw at one point it was largely advertising that supported us. And then we had some money that we'd made with circulation and subscriptions. At some point, about 5 years ago, that tipped, and now it's mostly subscription revenue. But we, like a lot of people, are struggling to continue to do that, and we're stable, but we don't see a lot of growth in that. So we just have to. A biggest part of my week these days is working on seeking support. And that was something a year ago I was never doing.
It's a fascinating bit of information. We'll talk more about that in the show to come, but we are out of time at this point. Imagine that.
Why?
What a great show. Thank you, folks. We didn't get to the letters we've gotten. We'll get to those next week. We'll get back to more of this conversation. Thanks to Miles Reed, editor of the Daily Gazette, Barbara Lombardo, formerly editor of the Saratogian and executive editor of the Record, and Troy, David Gustina, our wonderful producer, WAMC's morning host, and I'm Rex Smith.
You say that over the air.
I do. Thank you all for joining us. Hope you'll come back again next week for The Media Project.
Actors upon a living stage now. Newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild. Got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill. All together fits the bill.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian, and editor and vice president of the Daily Gazette, Miles Reed. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
And to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.